Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The conventional wisdom was that few, if any, Florida school districts would approve armed teachers in the classroom. But is the conventional wisdom wrong?
I know in my district, almost every one of our teachers would do anything to protect a child from getting shot.
Also this week, we'll talk with one of the driving forces behind Florida's sweeping revamp of its criminal justice system.
Well, I think it's a really good first step. I think we've got a lot of additional work to do. There's no doubt that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Florida.
We'll also explore the potential of a brand new Florida cash crop and recall the words of a legendary legal scholar whose work and wisdom will resound for many generations to come. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The number of Florida school districts that want teachers to carry guns is growing. Nearly half the districts in the state have signed up for the so-called Guardian program, and more have signaled they intend to do so. Lynn Hatter has more.
During a recent State Board of Education meeting, members heard the statistic.
There are 30 school districts now that have the agreement between the superintendent and the sheriff.
Alex Kelly is chief of staff to Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran. He noted another 13 districts are interested. Since that time, Okaloosa and North Florida's Panhandle became the latest to signal its participation. The Guardian program allows teachers and other school officials to carry guns. It requires the approval of both the local school board and the superintendent. Participants must undergo more than 140 hours in firearms and safety training and take psychological exams and undergo additional background checks. Another recent signee is Bay County Schools. Superintendent Bill Husfeldt says he made the decision to approve the Guardian program because 9 years ago, the school board was held hostage.
There is no way that anyone understands the helplessness you feel when someone's got a gun pointed at you and you have no way to protect yourself or intervene or anything.
Husfeldt says that experience, coupled with the Parkland shooting, prompted his decision.
There were people that were standing in front of a gunman protecting and shielding children with their bodies. And my concern is that I know in my district, almost every one of our teachers would do anything to protect a child from getting shot. And I think that what the least we can do is help those that can be trained, that can meet the requirements for the psychological background, the background screening and all that, they can do that to give them a fighting chance.
Last year's Valentine's Day shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High was among the worst in the nation. 17 people were killed, another 17 injured. Florida lawmakers created the Guardian program in the wake of that shooting and named it after Coach Aaron Feiss, who shielded students and was killed. The program was initially for personnel other than teachers, but lawmakers expanded it this year to include them. Participation is voluntary. It's also controversial. Shortly after the Florida Department of Education announced the number of districts planning to participate in the Guardian program, State Board of Education member Michael Olenek went on record with his concerns.
In my mind, it's wrong. It's a debate that we'll have forever. But in my heart of hearts, I think it was a wrong decision.
And he cited the reservations of Broward Sheriff Gregory Tony.
One of his quotes was, "Having untrained personnel carrying firearms is more likely to create a tragic scenario where innocent people can get injured or killed. Having more firearms in an active shooter situation would make it more difficult for police officers to ID the shooter."
Tony was appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis, who backs the program. Critics maintain parents and teachers don't want it, but the number of districts signing on to the Guardian program suggests otherwise. And the Department of Education is suggesting a majority of the state school districts will eventually have the program in place, leaving those that don't in the minority. I'm Lynn Hatter.
This legislative session, Florida lawmakers approved an overhaul of the state's criminal justice system for the first time in years. If signed into law, it would make major changes, including raising the felony theft threshold for the first time in more than three decades. Sean Mulcahy spoke about the bill with the Senate sponsor, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis.
Senator Brandis, you know, you've been a major proponent of criminal justice reform. You've really led the charge for years now to overhaul the state's prison system. So first, I guess, how do you feel? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a really good first step. I think we've got a lot of additional work to do. There's no doubt that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Florida, that Florida's, you know, really behind as it relates to criminal justice reform if we look at the other large states.
So you mentioned there's still work to be done. You know, some criminal justice reform advocates I've spoken to are disappointed that the House bill rather than the Senate bill passed. The House bill was sort of a more watered-down version. You know, it really only ends one mandatory minimum. So some people are calling it a missed opportunity for the legislature. What's your response to that?
On that, I would say I agree. I mean, I think there's a lot more we can do. Again, this was really a first step. It really gets the ball rolling. It gets the legislature comfortable with the idea of discussing criminal justice reform. I think that's incredibly important. It can't be understated. That this is a legislature that while this feels and doesn't nearly go as far as obviously I would want it to, this is really the first major reform the legislature has done in frankly, decades. And so I think it gives us the opportunity to keep coming back, keep working on it. A major portion of this bill was a study that takes place that looks at the overall criminal punishment code, which hasn't been reviewed again in decades. So I think the opportunity is to come back over the next 3 or 4 years and really redefine what criminal justice looks like in a state like Florida.
I want to go back and press you on that study. The bill doesn't ease sentencing guidelines, but like you said, it creates a task force to study them and then make recommendations to the legislature. But I mean, we've seen these mandated studies before. How confident are you that there'll be substantive findings and more so that your colleagues will actually act on them?
Well, I think if everyone takes it very seriously, if we get information out of it, I believe that there will be many actionable items that come out of this review. We know where Florida has been an outlier, and we've seen results in other states of some of the reforms that are needed in Florida. We would expect the results of Florida to look very similar to the performance of other states. So I think that you're going to see us have to act in some ways. I mean, I think what you see is our Department of Corrections is in crisis in many ways. Almost not a day goes by I don't read something about some issue in the Department of Corrections, whether it's solitary confinement, whether it's abuse, whether it's the shortage of guards, whether it's facilities problems. That is really one of the reasons that Florida's got to do something. It has to begin to reform its criminal justice system.
Now, one aspect of this bill could actually lead to more people being in prison and create stricter sentences for certain offenders. That provision expands what's known as prison releasee reoffenders, or PRR. That's people who commit certain crimes within 3 years of incarceration. So currently, that only applies to people who've been in federal or state prisons, but this bill expands it to include people who've been in county jails. And it kind of seems to me like that's counter to the rest of the bill's intent. So I guess, why was that included in this package?
Well, PRR is somebody who's got a continuing criminal history. And so what it was found is you could have felons that were released from a county jail. And just because they were released from the county jail, they wouldn't be included as essentially a career criminal. So we wanted to rectify that. But I think the PRR statute is something that I hope that we can review and address. Because we have situations where we have individuals who got convicted of a crime where no one was injured. It potentially was a violent crime, but no one was injured or killed. And the person is serving life without parole because they got a felony at 19, and then they got another felony at 21. This one just happened to be a violent felony, but they're now sentenced for the rest of their life to prison. I think there is an opportunity to review and potentially have some resentencing opportunities for these individuals who may be, by the time they turn 40, have been reformed. And it's the best interest of everyone, including the state, to not have them continue to be in prison for the rest of their lives when they've proven that they've been reformed because of some felony in their 20s.
That was reporter Sean Mulcahy speaking with Senator Jeff Brandis. Still to come on Capitol Report, Panhandle residents impacted by Hurricane Michael are still waiting for relief from Congress.
Needs to be passed as soon as possible for the welfare of our people in this country who have been attacked by natural disasters.
the abuse of a special needs child by an Okaloosa County school teacher could cost that county school superintendent her job permanently.
Her defense is saying she's the furthest away from this situation, and she has put other people in place to make sure they report.
And Florida is honoring a legal legend who died a few weeks ago at the age of 85.
We really had a sense that we were doing something to better the system.
Members of the U.S. House are continuing to block a $19 billion package that would send long-awaited disaster relief to Florida's storm-ravaged panhandle. Regan McCarthy has more.
Florida leaders have been calling for more help from the federal government for months.
They need to pass the supplemental. It's being tied up in stuff that's totally unrelated. And these folks have been waiting for a long time. And if you look for a Category 5 storm, the amount in that supplemental is a fraction of what other storms have received.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis speaking to a group of reporters a few weeks ago. Since then, the U.S. Senate has approved a proposal that would send money to Northwest Florida and help address flooding and wildfires in other parts of the country. The Senate passed the measure just before Congress took a break surrounding the Memorial Day weekend.
If the Speaker of this House felt that this was must-pass legislation, the Speaker of this House should have called a vote on this bill before sending every member of Congress on recess for 10 days, and I object.
That's Kentucky Republican Congressman Thomas Massey. He's one of three congressmen to object to a move to pass the spending plan without the full House being present. Tennessee Republican Congressman John Rose is the most recent member to raise objections.
I am standing in a House chamber that is virtually empty. Nearly all of my 431 colleagues are absent as the Speaker of the House seeks to pass a $19 billion spending bill. Our nation is $22 trillion in debt. Trying to pass nearly $20 billion in new spending while the majority of Congress is not even in Washington reflects another act of irresponsible big government. This is absolutely, without a doubt, wrong.
Legislation can be approved by unanimous consent even without most members being present, but raising an objection stops the process. Maryland Democratic Congressman Steny Hoyer says people in the panhandle have been waiting long enough, and they shouldn't have to wait for Congress to return from its break before they can start getting relief. Before Massey could make his objection, Hoyer tried to dissuade him.
And the sooner that we pass this bill, which we passed in January to the Senate, which we passed some 3 or 4 weeks ago, needs to be passed as soon as possible for the welfare of our people in this country who have been attacked by natural disasters.
But Massey raised his objection anyway. Members of Congress are expected to return to D.C. Monday for regularly scheduled committee meetings. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida's director of cannabis thinks 2020 could be the state's first great grow year for hemp. A bill launching a state hemp program is waiting for ink from the governor's pen. Ryan Daly reports experts in the state and elsewhere have been weighing in on an industry that will be a new frontier in the Sunshine State.
State Cannabis Director Holly Bell recently gave a mental picture of the procedure by which hemp becomes product. That includes hemp-infused skincare and hair products and CBD edibles, just to name a few.
It is the cannabis plant. It has about a 4-month grow cycle. It is very photosensitive, meaning light sensitive. So you grow it, you pick it, you dry it, you process it down to a crude oil that's a sludgy green looking thing, not very appealing. That's called full spectrum. And then you can run it through another machine and break it down into very specific isolates that they sell and put in products.
Bell says growing permits for the state hemp program could be issued before the year is out. She adds it may be optimistic, but that could happen as early as late fall. First, the rules must be set in motion.
Once we get our rules done, we'll post them to the system called FAR. Then public can review them, make comments. The internal group will review them, make sure we've done our job. If we have no objections, then we can adopt our rules and start a program.
But Bell is also concerned with safely regulating hemp for consumption. Also in the works, she says, is a framework for testing hemp grown by Florida farmers.
Currently, there are no regulations in the state of Florida for that being tested. The new bill will set into action a very specific requirement for that.
Hemp farmers should also expect to give Bell and the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services GPS coordinates of where they will grow and store their crop.
Once a year, you have to give me permission to come on your property also. I'm going to come out and take a sample of your crop, and I'm going to test it.
And Bell says if your finished product is intended for human consumption, there will be additional regulations.
The bill is very specific about what you have to do to sell in our state. You have to have a third party test that. You have to have a very specific label on your bottle that has a QRC code or a barcode that allows the consumer to go to a site where they can view your certificate, your COA, that the lab is giving you, verifying that your product is what you say it is or what the label says it is.
So how important is accurate advertising on labels for CBD products? Bill Gurley, a professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the University of Arkansas, studied a number of CBD products in Mississippi to find out if consumers are getting what's been advertised to them.
This study provides a snapshot of CBD product quality, or lack thereof, and is likely representative of the fraudulent nature of many, if not most, CBD products currently sold on the U.S. market.
Gurley, who was one of many who presented at the Food and Drug Administration's first public hearing on CBD, says in many cases people weren't getting what they expected. The study looked at 25 products purchased from various stores in Mississippi, which were tested by law enforcement officials from the state's Bureau of Narcotics.
Now, in most instances, product label claims misrepresented the actual CBD content within the product. Percent label claims range from indeterminate values, in other words, there was no claim for CBD, to products that contained very little CBD, to others that far exceeded the label claim. In one instance, the CBD content was almost 23 times greater than the quantity claimed on the label.
CBD products typically come with the promise that they contain only a minuscule amount of THC, the compound in marijuana that gets you high. That usually amounts to about 0.3% or less of the product. But Gurley says his study found that isn't always the case.
In three instances, THC content exceeded 0.3%, with one product containing 45% THC.
And Gurley called what he found in one product disconcerting.
The one product was adulterated with synthetic cannabinoid.
Synthetic cannabinoids are the chemicals that create a euphoria in now-outlawed synthetic marijuana products like Spice and K2. So why isn't CBD being more tightly regulated to protect consumers? Colorado's former director of cannabis coordination recently told the Economic Club of Florida it's still illegal, with the exception of one medication intended to treat epilepsy in children.
All of that is still technically illegal under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. And so this is a giant, it's not even a gray area, it's actually just illegal, but it's we'll say it's a gray area because of enforcement.
CBD sales haven't been shut down, Friedman says, because nobody wants to be the bad guy.
Nobody wants to come in and say, we're gonna shut this all down overnight. A few people tried, and then the backlash from the public was so great that it was difficult to get through.
Even without legalization at the federal level, Florida is moving forward with a framework for its coming hemp industry. And Bell says to her that future looks bright.
2020 is going to be our first, I believe, great grow year here for industrial hemp.
Bell says producers can take advantage of an immediate market for CBD and hemp products. I'm Ryan Daly.
On Capitol Report, we talk about a lot of educational issues in the course of this program. Everything from charter school support to testing results for students and all that. But there's a little bit of a scandal that's been going on out in Okaloosa County in the northwest part of the state, Blaise Gainey. And you've been following that. It even involves the school district superintendent, right?
Okaloosa's former school superintendent, Mary Beth Jackson, she was ultimately suspended by Governor Ron DeSantis after he received a recommendation from Richard Corcoran, the Commissioner of Education here in the state of Florida. And it didn't work out good for her, or it doesn't look too good for her, but she's trying to get reinstated. Her attorneys have been in court 2 days this week pleading to the special master over the case to say, hey, she did not do anything wrong in this situation. And with the knowledge that she knew at the time, she made the right decisions.
Okay, so this doesn't really involve her wrongdoing per se. It's somebody else's, right?
Yes, exactly. It's Kenwood Elementary teacher Marlon Stillions, our former teacher, I should say. She's now serving a 7-year sentence for the child abuse that Eddie Perillo, the father of a 4-year-old autistic kid, brought up. He found out about the report after the fact, and like most parents, was upset that he was not alarmed about this abuse involving his kid, and took the report directly to the media and law enforcement. A month later, Stillions and others were arrested who believed should have been reporting this abuse.
And that's the job of the superintendent of any school district, to be aware of where there may be some possible problems that need intervention. And this was not done in this case, right?
Exactly. I mean, the state is essentially saying, hey, she is the superintendent. Anything that happens under her, you can say was her. She's the one responsible for training and making sure that people are reporting on time. But her defense is saying she's the furthest away from this situation, and she has put other people in place to make sure they report, you know. And they also say there's no state recommendations about how often somebody needs to be trained on reporting, and the policies in Okaloosa County were up to date, just like other policies in every other county. So they're saying she did everything and put everything in the right place for this situation to be handled. But the people who are now serving time or on probation for this are the ones that should have reported this.
We've had a couple legal procedures so far this week. Where do we go from here, Blaze? What happens next?
From here, the court reporter will have to publish the hearing, everything that was said. She said that may take about 2 weeks. 45 days after that is when both sides will submit their findings to support their case to the special master. That's expected to be around August 1st. As early as September, in the first committee weeks, the Senate could make a decision on this.
So we may have to wait till the start of school before we find out what the status is of the superintendent of schools in Okaloosa County.
Currently, the interim superintendent there, Mario Chambers, was actually Mary Beth Jackson's subordinate at the time. And so her defense is saying, hey, how are you going to hire the person that was under her, who also should have been aware of this because he was over human resources at the time? It's a really weird situation going on there in Okaloosa.
A little bit of Peyton Place, if I remember that old movie and TV series back in the 60s. Thank you so much, Blaze Gainey. We'll talk to you in September.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the state of Florida and indeed the nation as a whole lost an historic figure on May 20th. Talbot Sandy D'Alembert died suddenly at the age of 85. For those unfamiliar with this transformative individual, he was an American lawyer, professor, politician, educational administrator, president of the American Bar Association, and president of Florida State University from 1994 to 2003. But that's just the thumbnail version of this man's long and distinguished career. Just over 7 years ago, we sat down with D'Alembert to get some sense of what he considered personal highlights of that career. The interview took place in a tidy corner of the FSU Law School, where he, along with his wife and legal partner Patsy Palmer, maintained a busy law practice. D'Alembert had just received an award named for Richard Irvin, who served on the Florida Supreme Court from 1964 to 1975, part of that time as Chief Justice. But before that, Irvin was Florida Attorney General when a young FSU law student named Sandy D'Alembert came knocking on his door looking for a summer job. D'Alembert got the job and a lifelong appreciation for Irvin's part in helping dismantle segregation upon reaching the high court.
Dick Irvin was a
a strong person, very much identified with North Florida values, but he also believed strongly in the Constitution and believed strongly that everybody should have an opportunity to get an education.
Those same principles would guide Gallenberg throughout his career, including his stint in the Florida House from 1966 until 1972.
Great opportunity I had to serve in the legislature, and I served as chair of the Judiciary Committee at a time when we rewrote the judicial article. Dempsey Barron was a good friend of mine, and Dempsey worked the Senate side, I worked the House side. I had an advantage over Dempsey because I had a staff director named Janet Reno. Those were wonderful times because we really had a sense that we were doing something to better the system.
Fast forward to 1989, having achieved national prominence and respect as an outstanding legal mind, Gallenberg was vying for the presidency of the American Bar Association. That campaign just happened to coincide with the fall of the Soviet Union.
Suddenly, American lawyers had the opportunity, if we would seize it, to go and take a part in helping to restructure, re-educate, reform legal systems in Central and Eastern Europe. And I'm proud to say that the American Bar Association grabbed that opportunity. And so I spent a lot of my time over those years after 89, the early 90s, in Central and Eastern Europe.
But the pull of Dallenberg's alma mater proved irresistible. In 1993, Governor Lawton Chiles appointed him president of Florida State University, a position Dallenberg held through 2003. A very active law practice followed, mostly focused on cases connected with human and civil rights issues. And during our conversation, Dallenberg expressed a point of personal pride that he had contributed to the cause of keeping America's judicial system isolated from the changing winds of politics.
The judiciary is not a political branch. There are attempts today to make it political, to politicize the judiciary. But in the communist system, they had done the ultimate job of politicizing the system. The judges were responding directly to the Communist Party leaders. And so the judges were doing the popular thing. Probably the majority of people wanted them to be responsive to the party at that time. But they were not protecting dissidents. They were not protecting minorities. They were not willing ever to do the unpopular thing, meaning that people's freedoms were protected. In the United States, and I'm proud to say, in Florida, judges act with considerable independence.
Visitation will take place this coming Tuesday evening, June 4th, at the Dallenberg Rotunda at the FSU College of Law. The memorial service, called a Celebration of Life, will take place at 2 o'clock the following day, Wednesday, June 5th, at the university's Ruby Diamond Concert Hall. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.